Welcome. My name is Julian Schlossberg, and the name of our show is Movie Talk. Our show today continues my talk with the incredibly talented Betty Buckley. We'll speak to her about starring in the hit television series Eight is Enough and the unbelievable ups and downs of that experience. It's one of the most incredibly honest interviews I've ever had, and I think you'll find it incredibly honest as well. Okay, we haven't even discussed, you've mentioned it, thank goodness, Eight is Enough.
They were auditioning everybody in Hollywood who was right for the character of the stepmother, because the show was a hit, and Diana Hyland, who's a beautiful woman, and was also in a relationship with John Travolta, but she was actually in her 40s, and I was like 28, 29 years old, and I had just done that one film. I hadn't had much television experience at all, just a couple of little things. And so they flew me out because Brandon told them Miss Collins, the character I played in Carrie, was a good prototype for this new character, the stepmother. And see, Diana, they'd done six episodes. The show was a huge hit. And then she was diagnosed with cancer and died very shortly after that diagnosis, which was a huge loss to everybody. And she was a lovely, lovely, beautiful woman and beautiful actress. And so they flew me out to audition, and apparently I didn't do a very good audition. And so Brandon persisted, said, no, she's the right person, and had them fly me back. And they hired this for the second audition, their main director, who was this lovely guy named Harry Harris, really nice man and a wonderful director, wonderful sense of humor and really sweet. And so he directed my second audition, and then that worked. And then they offered me the part. And I never heard of making that much money before. I mean, I worked on Broadway, you know, for so little money. And I was like, ooh, that's cool. And so I knew I hadn't even watched Eight is Enough. And they, you know, this family, but they told me that she was going to be a young woman who was studying to get her doctorate in that she, you know, she drove an MG, a classic MG. You know, she was supposed to be a young, contemporary, hip woman. And so those were the promises they made. So I signed a deal memo, and I had this new agent at that point. And the agency really sold me out. And Lorimar Productions was a young production company. They had the Waltons, and they had ultimately Dallas, too, and then Eight is Enough. And they were this, you know, hot, young production company. So somebody said, oh, it's like that TV show Family. And I liked Family. I'd seen Family, and I liked the lady on that. Michael Learned played the mother on that. And I thought, oh, she's cool. She's a really good actress. You know, that would be fun. Okay, I'll do that. And so I went out, and I was staying at the Chateau Marmont, and, you know, I had to drive myself to work. So somebody told me about Bundy Rent-A-Wreck because I didn't have a car. So I rented a Bundy Rent-A-Wreck, and I was staying at the Chateau Marmont to, you know, sustain my rock and roll fantasy for the life I was supposed to have as this, like, you know, authentic actress thing and person. And because I was really, you know, I wanted to be a serious actress. I wanted to be as good as, you know, Maureen Stapleton or Kim Stanley, and then later on Jenna Rollins. I wanted to be a really good actress, you know. And so I'm like going every once a week to Stella Adler classes in New York, and then in LA, I immediately enrolled there too. And so from the very beginning, it was just not my world, you know. Like, there was no costume designer. The girls on the show that looked good is because their mothers dressed them. And I was like, what do you mean? There's no wardrobe, you know? It's like, I've been working on Broadway with brilliant costume designers, like nobody to help you figure this stuff out. And they had neglected to negotiate my hotel, and there was no time to go shopping for a house or an apartment because I'd gone right to work. And so there was all this stuff, and I suddenly discovered that I was spending all my money on my hotel, right? It was kind of crazy. And it just one thing after another. My first day on the set, they're trying different wigs on me to see what color my hair should be. And I had this kind of sandy blonde hair, and nobody'd ever questioned what, you know, but it wasn't with none of my permission. It was just like, we'll decide what color your hair is going to be. And I'm like, I'm acting like a clown with these platinum wigs on and stuff. And I'm like, you know, acting really stupid because I was so taken aback by the
whole setup.
Yeah, the audaciousness, the lack of courtesy, the lack of respect, you know, it was just really awful. And from the beginning, and then they were putting this like heavy pancake makeup on my face. And I have like really fragile Irish skin, you know. And they didn't ask my permission about that either. And they were like, oh, you have to be really tan because Dick Van Patten's tan and all the kids are tan. And I'm like, I'm not tan. And they're like, it doesn't matter, you know. And I'm like, it does to me. And so I go on the weekend to a makeup artist to teach me how to do my makeup for the show. And they're like, she's doing her own makeup. Outrageous. You know, and everything was a problem. Everything. And my first day, my first scene, I love this kid named Willie Ames, who played the young one of the, he was 15, was one of the young boys on the show. And I loved him. I thought he was like a young James Dean and stuff. He was a good actor. And so I was excited to work with everybody. And I went on the set and I said, oh, I had some thoughts about this scene. I started to talk to him. He looks at me and he goes, who does she think she is? And he walked off the set. And the head of the, you know, the production head comes in and goes, what's going on? You're doing your own makeup. You know, you're upsetting the 15-year-old. And I'm like, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to do that or whatever. It just went from bad to worse. And the following Saturday morning, the makeup artist, I would sit down in the chair and I'd be like, what is going on here, you know? And if I make a mistake in a take and I said the word shit, you know, I'd be like, shit, you know, like I forgot a line or something. They were going, you can't curse in front of the kids, you know? And there was like, the script supervisor was the acting coach for the kids and she was insane. And everything about the thing was, I was like, what is going on? Why? And the makeup artist would lean down and say, you know, Laura Mars owned by the mob. You better not make waves till you get the ratings. And I was basically supposed to have co-star billing. And then they start renegotiating because they're not sure they've hired the right girl, right? I'm from Texas. And when people treat me rudely or disrespectfully when I was younger, especially, I was pretty outspoken. I'd be like, hey, dude, you know. Anyway, it was not cool. And so this went on. They started renegotiating the terms of my contract. They want now not to give me co-star billing, but to wait 6 episodes to see if the audience likes me. And then they'll decide if they're going to marry me into the family. So basically, we're renegotiating my deal. And so the agent arrives at my hotel room on a Saturday morning. He's knocking at the door. I don't even know he's coming. And he comes in my suite and he sits down on the couch and puts his feet up on the coffee table and said, you're going down like a sinking ship. You know, and I was like, what? What are you talking about? And he goes, you know, don't make waves till you get the ratings. It was on and on. And I was like, hey, we had a deal and they're not living up to the terms of the deal. So what is going on? And in the meantime, they're doing everything they can to do this psychological intimidation routine about how they will hurt me because they are owned by the mafia. And I was horrified, right? I never experienced anything like this in my life. So I met this wonderful guy, a producer named Marty Bregman. Do you remember him?
I do.
He was such a great guy, and he produced Al Pacino's first couple of movies and stuff. And I met him when I was in London, and I was doing Promises, Promises.
And he was a New York producer, not L.A. He was New York.
He was a great man. And I met him, and he wanted to manage me. He saw me in the show and stuff. And his clients literally were Al Pacino, Bette Midler, and me. And I'm like, and his partner took me to see Bette Midler when I came back to the States. And she was fully formed in her early 20s. And I wasn't, you know, I was just like, you know, he had me audition for Hal Prince. They offered me to replace in Cabaret. And
Jill Hayworth?
Yeah, somebody. I can't remember all the details of that. And he turned it down. And he told them, nah, she wants to be in film. And I'm like, what? No, I want to be in the musical theater. Anyway, he was a lovely guy and very, very nice to me. And I went to him, or this was before Ages Enough, and I'd seen Bette Midler. And I went to him and I said, Mr. Bregman, I'm very, very grateful for your interest in my talent, you know, but I'm not there yet. I'm still trying to figure out who I am in the business. And I just want to be a really good actress and a really good singer. And I'm just basically a student. So I don't think there's anything for you to represent. And he said, well, Betty, I'm, you know, really sorry you feel that way. Let's stay in touch. And if you ever need help, if you ever need, call me. And I was like, I remembered that. So I'm out there doing my first big series after my one film, right? And I call him in the middle of the night. It was like the early morning hours.
You're a desperate woman at this point.
I'm crying. I'm terrified. I'm in the Chateau Marmont, terrified of the mafia coming to kill me or something. I mean, I was so naive, but I never met people like this ever in my life, you know? And I was really mad at how they were treating me. And, oh, you know, they promised me that she was working on her doctorate and stuff. And they put me in muumuus, you know, like, and I had to go shop for my own clothes on the show. It was crazy. And so I was asking the agent to audition, to, since they opened the negotiation, to get me my hotel room and to get a proper costume designer and, you know, the stuff that was necessary to how I was living out there. Just, you know, there was no, I couldn't even find a place to live except the hotel I was staying in. So.
But you've called Marty Bregman now, right?
I call Marty Bregman and I'm sobbing and crying, telling him what's going on and how they're the mob and blah, 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 and I don't know what to do. And he's so sweet. He goes, Betty, I want you to go take a hot bath and go to sleep. I'll call you in the morning. Everything's taken care of. So he calls me the next day and he said, at lunch, go to this restaurant. You're meeting a major attorney. So Barry Hirsch was this like huge Hollywood gunslinger attorney. And he had just renegotiated Lorraine and Shirley's deal, like record-breaking deal in television. And so it was funny because they picked this really Italian restaurant because they were amused that I was so scared of the would-be mobsters, right? And so I knew that I seemed like a dipshit and I seemed like a really naive, dopey girl. And I was rather enjoying their amusement at the situation, but I was really scared, right? And it was very upsetting to work for Lorimar. And I sit down with Barry Hirsch and one of his associates, and they were very kind and said, don't worry, Betty, we're your attorneys now. We've got it handled. He wrote Lee Rich, the head of Lorimar. One letter, he said, dear Lee Rich, I now represent Betty Buckley. Barry Hirsch. Everything changed after that. Everything fell into place. He fired my agent. He started a negotiation with them and then continued to negotiate for me for the 4 years, renegotiate. They took care of me after that. But, and so I really, I then, you know, had the courage to go confront them about, they were writing the role as a 1950s mother as opposed to a contemporary. And I'm like, I'm from Texas. I'm from Middle America. You know, women are not like you're writing here, and I don't want to play. It's not, you know, I try. So I really guided them in terms of a balance to what. And the first 2 years was very difficult. the last 2 years, they got it all worked out and it was much, much better. But then, and this will shortcut to the end, they canceled us and we heard about it on the streets. They didn't even have the courtesy to call us and say, we're not doing another season. Because by the fourth season, everybody had lawyered up and was renegotiating and they realized they could make more money just putting the show in syndication than doing another season where the family unit had grown from 8 kids and 2 parents to nephews and boyfriends and husbands of the girls and so forth and so forth. So at the last party, this is wild. I was at the party. My brother was my date, Norman Buckley, my brother, who's a filmmaker now and, you know, wonderful, successful filmmaker. Lee Rich comes sauntering over to me, all cocky and everything. And he goes, you know, Betty, for us to get together, there'll be a time and a place. And I said, in your dreams, Lee, in your dreams. And that really offended him. And I was like, I thought he was joking. So I was being jocular, I thought. But at the same time, both of us were really, you know, there was a pointed thing behind it. And he said, oh, I see. He says, you think you've won this war, don't you? And I said, what war? And he said, you may have won a few battles, but we will win the war. And I said, what war, Lee? I said, I've helped you. I've been a contributor to helping make a very successful television. We were number one, number two, number three all the time in the ratings. And I said, so I've helped you make a very successful enterprise. It's, you know, I've made a lot of contributions to this show that I know about. And I said, I've helped you make millions of dollars. Why would you want to do that? He said, you'll see. Wherever you go from now on, we will get there first and we will destroy your reputation. And I said, okay, well, let's see. And sure enough, for 12 years, every job I was up for, like everything, my manager at that point, which would come back and say, they say you're difficult. They don't want to see you. And I'm like, I'm a freaking team player and I'm a creative artist and I'm, you know, I've helped a lot of people make a lot of money. What are they talking about? And that went on. But then, oh, one other classic story about Eight is Enough. And I've got a lot of them. We had this, one of the producers on the show was this guy named Greg, who wore black all the time. He had sleek black hair and he drove a black Porsche. We're at Burbank Studios, and I'm getting in my Bundy Rent-A-Wreck to go to the airport to fly to New York for the weekend so I can study with my voice teacher. And he goes, he drives by me as I'm in my Bundy Rent-A-Wreck, and which is, mind you, a car with dents all over it, which was very effective, you know, because people are so invested in their cars in Hollywood. But yeah, they'd see me coming, and they just move over, you know. It's like, because they were like, they knew I had nothing to lose. And so Greg was like, where are you going? And I said, I'm going to New York for my voice lesson. He goes, Betty, you have such delusions of grandeur. You'll be lucky if you play American Mothers for the rest of your life on television. He said, but you will never work in the musical theater. And I said, oh, we'll see, Greg, we'll see. And so I was all happy as my career went on. And I played a cat. I played a boy in Edwin Drood. I played an old man in Edwin Drood. I played an alcoholic country western star in the film Tender Mercies. You know, I was just like, every show I would be like, yes, see, Greg, see.
It's amazing how some people can affect your life. They think they're going to do it negatively. You use it and turn it into a positive thing. And that's really, that's the best kind of alchemy that you can do.
Well, my career really is, there have been so many kind people that have really opened doors for me and made it possible for me. I mean, Roger Hess, Charlie Blackwell, you know, Howard De Silva. I mean, the list goes on and on. Stuart Ostro, you know, just Trevor Nunn, Andrew Lloyd Webber. All these people have made it possible for me to keep working when I didn't know much and then be hired when I finally learned what I was doing. I had the time to grow. That's what I'm trying to say.
Well, you did. And I want to talk now about Sunset Boulevard, because this is I have to say, I've been going to theater since Mary Martin knocked me out as Peter Pan.
Yeah.
So that I was 13 years old, so that's 70 some odd years I've been going to theater. And I went to see, as your guest, your performance in Sunset Boulevard. And to this day, I will tell you that of all the shows I've seen, this is one of the greatest evenings of my life.
And thank you, Julian. Thank you.
What you were able to do on that stage as Norma Desmond is just extraordinary. And when you sing that line, I'm going to cry myself. When you sing that line, "I've come home again." Mm. Oh, my God. The place erupted. I thought produced and directed a movie called No Nukes with Bruce Springsteen. I had to go to the Garden 5 nights a week. That's the loudest noise I ever heard. "I've come home again." And
I've come home at last. I've come home at last.
Right. Well, all I can tell you is I was kind. You were kind enough to take me backstage after I had seen the performance to watch you in high heels with a 30-pound costume, making costume changes, running up and down staircases. You didn't have to go to a gym. You just went to the show every night.
No, I did have to go to a gym to be strong enough to do that
show. No, but I meant that was enough, though.
It was hard. It was really hard to run up and down those stairs in high heels for 12 times a performance, you know? It was wild, but it was one of the most gratifying jobs I've ever had. You know, it was just fabulous, fabulous.
Just fabulous. Well, let's talk in terms of, first of all, you do it in London, I believe, after Patti LuPone. And there's all kinds of hoopla going on about you're coming in, she's going out. It was really crazy. And my wife is from London, so we went to see Patti. We never saw you. We went back to America. Then we saw you in America. But what was it all about? And how daunting was it for you to be going through this kind of, I don't know what they were all screaming and yelling about. I guess Patti was leaving and she was supposed to do the show. It was all kinds
Patti
of stuff.
Yeah, Patti had a contract for London, LA, and New York. She had a contract for all of those. And so they opened the show in London. And the show got mixed reviews. And in fact, Frank Rich, the renowned New York Times critic, wrote a review of the London production. And basically, it was basically a letter to Andrew that he would kill the show. That his basic criticism was Norma Desmond would not be a high belt Broadway girl. You know, Patti, there's like a handful of us that were known for having this high belt voice, you know, where we could sing in a natural voice in a space that's normally your head voice, right? So then what happened was they cast, this review kind of shook Andrew's confidence because she had done the workshop and then she had this year in London and then she was supposed to open it in Broadway and then also LA if she chose to. And so they cast Glenn Close in LA. And Glenn, you know, this wonderful actress, and she was, well, so they lowered the keys for her. Now, the irony of this is rumor has it that Meryl Streep wanted to do this show at one point, and Andrew wouldn't lower the keys in the beginning. And so now he's lowering the keys because of what Frank Rich has said. And so that show, that version, the LA company with Glenn, received a rave review from Vincent Canby, who was the film critic of the New York Times. And so at the end of Patti's contract in London, Andrew, she was leaving then anyway. So they flew me to London to audition, and I was there for a week, and they taught me the score. And then they had me learn the songs in Glenn Close's keys as well. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to sing in my keys. And so I auditioned. I was there, like my audition went on for an hour and 10 minutes. I've never had an audition like that in my life. It was arduous. And fortunately, I had a really great analyst at this point named Aracelia Pearson Brock. And I talked to her on the phone almost the whole time I was there. And so I went to see the show for the first time and with her, Patty's understudy. And later I saw Patty do it. And I had seen video of the Glenn Close version, and I had seen some video of Patty's original interpretation as well. So I went to see the show, and I kind of knew, I had a really clear idea of what I should do with the part. I was in London, and they gave me a hotel suite, and I was rehearsing every day with the music director to get ready for this big hour, 10-minute audition at the end of the week. And I would tell her my opinions of the show and what I needed to do instead. And she goes, "Yes, but you're not going to say that, are you?" And I was like, "No, I'm not going to say that." And because I'm, you know, like I said, I'm this Texas girl, outspoken, and like, you know, I've shot myself in the foot a lot in my early career for being too opinionated, right? So, but anyway, so I did this audition, and Trevor, having we worked together in Cats and stuff, and so they were testing me to see if I was going to do what they wanted me to do. And he said to me, "You know, it's a long story, Julian." Anyway, I kept my mouth shut and I just did what he said. And so they waited 2 weeks to offer me the part, which was very nerve-wracking. And then they finally offered me the part. So I arrive in London, and they've made the decision as I was flying to London to cast Glenn Close in New York. And I was hoping they would wait to see what I was going to do with the show before they made that decision. But they made the decision because she had received this rave review from Vincent Canby, which was, he called it a Nosferatu version of Norma Desmond. And I was determined that I would not do that kind of interpretation. Version. And that I was going to make her this, like, human being, you know. And I'd studied lots and lots of silent, or all these film stars. I'd watched their films. I'd, you know, read their biographies, their autobiographies and stuff. And so, and unfortunately, they let me bring my Pilates trainer, this lovely man named Patrick Strong, with me to London, who really kept me on track, working out. And, you know, we'd watch these silent film stars together, and, you know, I'd take their choreography from the films and stuff. And so I was working on that, and I'm on the phone all the time with Aracelia, like how to talk to Trevor Nunn, right? Because I have all these big ideas. And she basically said, "Well, you know, he's a British director, so..." And my agent had in the past had said that too. He's a British director. He doesn't want to hear a Texas girl offer her opinions. And I'm like, right. So so in the beginning of the rehearsal process, I just did what he said. And then gradually I started introducing my ideas. And Aracelia had said to me, "Don't present these in psychological terms," because I was like a student of human psychology and all that stuff. He couldn't be less. "Present them in like historic references or mythological references or something like that." And I was like, okay. So after about the second week, I said to Trevor, the Greek myths, Medusa, you know, it's like she's enraged with the way the guy treats her. And so she kills them all, you know, and it's like, and he was like, that's interesting. Yeah, let me show me. And so bit by bit, piece by piece, he was letting me bring my interpretation to the show. And they got very nervous about it before we opened. I remember the wonderful choreographer, Bob Avion, took me to dinner. Everybody's saying, it's a, you know, what's the word? It's a it's a melodrama. It's a melodrama. It's soap opera. And I'm like, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I remember Bob Vivian taking me to dinner and saying, you know, it's a soap opera. It's a melodrama. And I'm like, yeah, yeah, okay, don't worry. Because I'm, you know, I was getting to the performance. And so I guess having learned from I'm in transition, I was like calming them down till I found my footing, right? And so, but I was very blessed that Trevor gave me the space to do this interpretation. And we opened and we got rave reviews. And so that was wonderful. And I was very grateful. And then they decided to bring me to New York to replace Glenn. And we went through a similar process because the New York Times basically did this feature story about me. Was I, quote unquote, a big enough star to replace this movie star, you know, Glenn Close? Very stressful experience. But again, we got the reviews and the audience went crazy. And 3 months after we opened, Trevor came backstage and he was like, the audience. And I was like, I told you, you know, because I felt I've always had this kind of intuitive awareness of where we are in the collective consciousness. And I knew that this like over the top repulsive version of this monster person, you know, I just felt like Norma had her right at her age, which at that point she was supposed to be 49 turning 50 as Gloria Swanson had been in the film, but she had a right to her own beauty, her glamour and her sexuality. And I wasn't going to play it as some repulsive thing between this younger guy and her. And that was at the heart of it. And people wanted that interpretation because that's where we were at as a culture. And so Trevor was really startled by the audience response to the interpretation because I refused to play her. I played her as a human being, not a monster. And so that's basically
it. What you did was, I would like to put my two cents in.
Okay.
What you did, number one, was make her vulnerable. Mm-hmm. That was so important. Number two, she wasn't crazy. She was portrayed crazy. You didn't let her be crazy. Number three, you understood why Joe Gillis had a physical, sexual attraction to her. You understood why it wasn't just that he was an opportunist. He really dug her. And so all of that you brought that no one else did.
Julian.
Well,
thank
it was
you.
True. And I've never forgotten it. You know, Betty, we probably have done 2 hours already.
I know. We should have we should do this as a series and then it'll be like, and that becomes my book, you interviewing me about all this stuff.
Because that book, I tell you, would be fantastic.
Let's do it again. It's so great to reconnect with you.
Thanks for joining us on Julian Schlossberg's Movie Talk. Remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Produced by Audavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world. Produced by Audavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.